We have two parshiot this week, and part of what I'm going to try to do is to show at least one theme that goes through the two of them. The first parsha begins with Parshat Matot. Vedeber Moshe el Roshe HaMatot. The word Matot is a very strange word. It's not frequently used. The word, the singular is Mateh. Right? A mate could have the implication of a staff, but it could also mean it could be a group. Matot is a series of groups. So Roshei HaMatot would be the heads of the various groups, or the implication, the heads of the various tribes, or leaders. Roshei HaMatot, leaders of groups. Now, there's a couple of things which are interesting in this verse. One is the use of the word matot. The other is what, those of you who recall the Rashbam, it's really what's lacking from this pasuk. And what was lacking? It forgot to write, and God said to Moshe, saying, speak to the heads of the various tribes, and this is what you should say to them. So over here we have, Redeber Moshe or Roshei Matot, Moshe speaks to the matot, and we have the absence of God telling him to do it. Now, Rashi deals with one problem, the Rashbam deals with the other problem. Together, everything is solved. Rashi over here writes, in the second source, Uma ra'a la'umra kan, lamad shahafarat nidarim biyachid mumche, v'mein yachid mumche, mafir b'sholsha hedyatot. So what Rashi here is teaching us a halacha. The halacha is, and how do you cancel vows? So what I wanted to stay away from, which somebody asked me right before class, is the whole ability of the husband or the father to be able to do, because that would be very unpolitic of me to speak about this in a class of women. So therefore, I decided I would very subtly stay away from it. Instead, what Rashi points out is a different phenomenon, and that's a phenomenon of the ability of canceling a vow after the vow is made, and we call that to be matir neder. We do this ceremoniously, either during Slichot, before Rosh Hashanah, or by Kol Nidre, which is a very funny thing. I mean, I would suspect that most Jews that get all choked up and by Kol Nidre have no idea what's being said. It's the music, okay? It's certainly not the... Certainly not the words. What we're saying, what we're doing by Kol Nidre, is apparently we're saying to God, listen, before we start dealing what we messed up, what we're supposed to do, first let's get rid of all the things we weren't supposed to do and we took upon ourselves, and let's then get down to what we broke that we were supposed to do. And that's the Kol Nidre. First we're canceling all vows, we're canceling it for the past, for the present, for the future, so all vows are off. Of course, what happens to vows, the fact that we say Kol Nidre every year is a question I'm not going to deal with, but there is this concept of being Matir Neder. The way that you Matir Neder, that you can cancel a vow, is either by going over to one expert, one mumcha, or to three hedyotot. There's a famous story which I heard from one of the people involved. Rabbi Soloveitchik used to stand up every year for davening for the silent Shemoneh Esrei. He would stand up, and then he would stand up for the Chazaret Hashatz. And on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, that can Musaf Ne'ilah can get quite long. And when he wasn't feeling well, then he, one year, he called over one of the rabbis. The RCA every year would have like a mini convention, and they would go up to Boston, and Rabbi Soloveitchik would speak. And my father used to bring me there, and one year after one of the talks, he calls over one of the rabbis, and it was Rabbi Berzon. I don't know if any of you know any of his children, or you know Rabbi Berzon himself.
No, I know his daughter was invited.
Greenwald. Okay. So he called over Rabbi Berzon and he said, "Can you make a beis din for me? Bring over two other rabbis and we'll make a beis din because I wanna cancel my vows." Because there is this idea that if you do a minhag of good, if you do something more than three times, which is a positive minhag, then it's also seen to be like a neder, and you have to go through the process of canceling it. So he said, put a beis din together for me that I can cancel it. So Rabbi Berzon says to Rabbi Soloveitchik, why do you need three people? You have me. You're just asking me. I'm a mumcha. I'll do it myself. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said to him, Rabbi Berzon, whether you're a mumcha or not, I don't know, but I do know that the rest of the rabbis here are hedyotos, which... It wasn't a compliment.
All right,
it wasn't a compliment to the rest of the rabbis of the RCA, but hedyotos means that they're... It's the opposite of mumcha. Is an expert. They're lay people, which means he didn't seem to... Right. So as I said, I heard this... Because we want there to be three people. We want there to be a proper quorum, a proper beis din. So, as I said, I heard that from Rabbi Berzon, had told me that story.
Is that something that you promise to somebody that's a mitzvah? Or is that something that's...
So, I'm not sure yet how much I'm going to get into the details of Nedarim. And there are two reasons I don't want to get into it. One reason is if I really do get into it, I'm not going to get to where I'm supposed to go. The other reason I want to get into it, because I don't know anything about it.
Okay.
But that's a secondary reason. Which means that the truth is, to really deal with Nedarim properly, you need to be a mumcha, and I can assure you that I am a hedyot. I don't know if I'm a level of the hedyoto of the RCA, but by the way, what I will say is the way that you cancel a vow is that you will, and I have sat in a beit din like this, the way that you do is you would sit there and you would look for what's called a petach. You would look for an opening. And you would say, if this would have occurred to you at the point that you made the vow, or if you would have realized this when you started to do this, would you have done it anyway or said it anyway? If the person says no, then this is the vow is canceled. Which means knowledge being missing. Again, in this particular case that Rabbi Soloveitchik gave, if you would have known that your back would have started hurting so intensely, would you have started this minhag in the first? And he says, no, then I wouldn't have done it. So then that would cancel it. And that's the way that you cancel vows. Okay? You find... Excuse me? Listen, we're dealing with honorable people here. We wouldn't assume that anybody's lying. But I'm saying, that's called a petach. That's how you open it up, and then the vow gets canceled. Now, why that works and how that works is really quite interesting, and maybe by the time I finish, I'll be able to come back to that. Because what it seems to be doing is, it's saying is that you have, by saying a vow, I am using words and I'm creating something. Or by doing an action, I'm using action and I'm creating something. But some reason thought can change either the action or can change the vow. Now, why thought should be involved in that is part of what we will hopefully be able to get to. Okay, full stop. Yeah. You don't have to apologize when you say something that has nothing to do with what I'm talking about.
No.
I'm used to it. Okay.
No.
Rashi was trying to understand the use of the word matot over here. Why do you need these heads of the matot? And Rashi is telling us that there's a law that's going to be derived from this. The law is you need either one expert or you need a group of people.
I don't get
why that's here?
No, I don't get
how that's connected to the...
Right,
so the problem... Right. The problem is that we're going only looking at half of Rashi. And we skip the whole beginning of it and we skip the end of it. There's another part afterwards that we skip. The Rashbam is bothered by the fact that God didn't say this, or where do we see that God said it? Lefi apshad heichan matzinu shum parsha she matchelet kein. Where do we find any parsha that starts like this? Shelo nemar lamala v'deber Hashem Moshe lemor ish ki yador neder. It doesn't say the more normative, and God said to Moshe, saying, when a man makes a vow or someone makes a vow, the heich matchelet haparsha b'dibur Hashem Moshe. Why should the parsha begin with Moshe said again v'deber Moshe el roshe matot she'ein mufrash lo mipi agvura? Which means, why is God's speech absent over here?
Why didn't we hear from Vayomer?
Right. And I think that there's something very deep going on over here, and let's continue. We then have, two chapters later, something which is clearly, completely disconnected from Parshat Matot, or the beginning of Matot. And that's the whole episode of the B'nai Reuven, Gad, and somehow, at some point, half of Menashe come into it as well.
So we're not answering Rashbam's question?
We're not answering anything. Nothing.
Okay.
If we're lucky. Listen, if you don't behave, then nothing comes together today. Now, what's interesting about this section is, again, looking at things in a purely, or maybe even an overly legalistic perspective, a couple of things happen. Now, let's go in order. B'nai Gad Reuven come and say, we have a lot of flock, and maybe we can stay over here. Moshe goes off on them, and Moshe attacks them. If you've noticed Moshe's attack, it's a very specific attack. What does Moshe accuse them of doing or of being? Like the Meraglim. Right? Moshe's attack is clearly one of being like the Meraglim. What was the problem of the Meraglim? The problem was that the words that they used caused the community to lose faith and to be scared and not to want to continue. So therefore, if you now say that you want to stay behind, it sounds like you're afraid of war, it sounds like you're afraid of conflict, it sounds like going into Israel isn't worth the effort for you, and therefore Moshe attacks them as being the same as the Meraglim. They come and say, no, quite the opposite. We're willing to go to war, we're willing to go to battle, it's just that we want to stay in this land over here. The main sin of the Meraglim, which again you can debate and you can argue with me, it seems that it takes place in source number 6, but you would see you diba ta'aretz. Diba is a term which would connotate that they spoke against the land. That they were guilty of, how would you say diba? It's not gossip, it's worse than gossip. It's what? Slander, malicious slander, which means it's using words to attack the land. And by the way, if you want to think this through a little bit, the first Beit HaMikdash, the sin of the first Beit HaMikdash, we're told is Gilei Raot Shefichat Damim Avodah Zarah. If you look at the sin of the golden calf, it has all three of them wrapped up there. Right? Avodah Zarah is easy. Gilei Raot, it says Kumulat Tzachek, Rashi there says Gilei Raot. And what about Ritzicha? What about Shefichat Damim? It says when Chur tries to stop them, they kill Chur. So right there you have Gilei Raot Shefichat Damim Avodah Zarah. That is by the golden calf. That's connected to the first Korban, where the Gemara tells us is connected to the to those three sins. The second Beit HaMikdash, we're told, is destroyed because of Sinat Chinam. Sinat Chinam, if you look in the introduction of the Chafetz Chaim to his book, the Chafetz Chaim, where he talks about Lashon Hara, there he tells us that how do you do Sinat Chinam? So he says that the way that you do Sinat Chinam is by gossiping about people. Now the reason why he's able to make this association is because there is another Gemara in Erechin that says that Rechilut is equal to Gilei Raot Shefichat Damim Avodah Zarah. On the other hand, we know that Sinat Chinam is equal to those. Therefore he says, no, we have, I guess, the associative principle over here, and therefore Sinat Chinam is Rechilut. So where do you find Rechilut over here by the sin of the spies? So the answer is right over here, Vaitu Diba Ta'aretz. And therefore you can then claim that the sin of the spies is connected to the second Beit HaMikdash, while the sin of the golden calf is connected to the first. Yeah.
I was under the impression that Lashon Hara is always the truth, and Rechilut is not the truth.
Correct.
So
Diba is not true here. Diba is already slanderous. So.
But slander can be true.
No. We need a lawyer here.
Okay.
I never thought I'd say that. So there you go. Slander is? Slander can be true.
So instead of being so
stupid, that's a
I can't sue you for slander because it's the truth that you said?
No. You want to use the word libel? You want to use the word libel?
When is just
so let's use.
When it's a slander, if someone said something
right.
That was true and you sued them, and it was true, then you're not.
Right. So you can sue someone for slander if what they say about you is not true. Then how much you get depends on how much intent and how much damage was done. Correct? Correct. Okay. 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 So, what we see then is Moshe's assumption is that their sin was somehow connected to the sin of the spies, which I am pointing out to you has to do with misuse of speech. They try to create a situation, an impression of a problem. And then afterwards, they deny everything. They know quite the opposite. We're willing to go and willing to fight and so on. We just want this land. And then what happens afterwards is something interesting, that the condition then that's made in Source 7, Vayitzav le Moshe, Elazar ken v'Yeshua ben Nun ve'el Roshei Avot ha-Matot, and it's interesting that the word Matot now comes up again, and then he sets up, you know, if they do this, this, and this.
But this was their idea. I mean, we went back, or I went back, all the conditions were actually with
Moshe's
idea. It was their idea.
Correct. Correct. What then happens is what becomes the archetype for all conditions afterwards. It needs to be a double-sided condition. If you do this and this, and this will happen. And that's what the Mishnah says in source number 8. Would be Meir Omer, Kol Tanai, She'enu Tanai Pnei God B'nei Reuven, Enu Tanai, She'ne'amar V'yomar Aleim, and then it goes in quotes. It means this becomes a Tanai. And again, I want to go back and focus on something. Where did we start the parasha with? We started with Nidarim. What's Nidarim? Nidarim is somehow the power of speech and the power of creating obligations and creating realities by saying something. We then have a possible sin or suspicion of sin that takes place, and that's because what Moshe perceives to be a misuse of speech. Then they come back and they say, no, this we'll do, and Moshe accepts it. And at that point, what do we find? At that point, we find, again, a way of creating a vow, creating an obligation, or create, if not exactly a vow, then creating conditions, creating a tnai. What I want, therefore, to go back and to think about, because this whole thing is very strange. A, it's strange why words should have such power. B, it's perhaps equally strange how you can possibly cancel a vow. In fact, the Mishnah in Source 9 says, "Heter nidarim porchin ba'avir." The ability to cancel vows sort of floats about in the air. What it means over here is that there are certain parts of Torah, which the end of the Mishnah speaks about, where there's an incredible amount of scripture, and if you look in the Mishnah and the Gemara, it's simply explaining the verses. There are certain things which have very, very limited representation in scripture. For example, relatively, the laws of Shabbat compared to the laws that we have, the 39 melachot, versus what it actually says in the Torah, it's an incredibly small percentage is written. When you get to laws like Heter Nedarim, that it says that's almost fantasy, because the ability for Beit Din to do, which Rashi's telling you, no, that's right there in Roshei Matot, the Mishnah says, yeah, it's very nice that Rashi said it. Of course, the Mishnah can't say that. Very nice that Rashi said that, but the ability to cancel a vow for Beit Din to do this is really not there. But it's one of these things which is really halacha Moshe Misinai, something which is passed on from generation to generation. So we have certain laws which are written very clearly. By the way, a lot of the laws of Korbanot and a lot of the laws of Tumah and Tahara. You have certain laws which are a little bit is written. The terms that use of Shabbat, Hochot Shabbat Chagigot V'Mi'ilot Harehem Keharurim Hatzloyim B'Sa'ara, mountains which are being supported by a string. But Heter Nedarim Prochim Ba'avir, there's not even a string which is holding them up, they're just somehow floating. So, on the one hand, how does a neder, or why does a neder, create a reality? On the other hand, how exactly does this work, that there's an ability of cancelling the reality? That was source number 9. And how exactly do you cancel the reality? So let's therefore go back to the beginning, I mean the beginning, the very beginning, and let's try to think some of this through and then see how far we can get. First of all, in source 11 we have something which we're all familiar with because we say it occasionally, and that is Baruch Sha'amar V'haya Olam Baruch Hu. So I don't know if you've ever thought about the words, because I know that would be antithetical to davening, to actually pause and to think about what it is that we say. But over here we say, Baruch, you know, blessed, Sha'amar, Bahaya Olam. Blessed he who speaks, and then the world appears. So that's a very interesting turn of phrase, because it's telling us how does creation takes place. Creation takes place by virtue of speech. And that's the more famous mission in Source 12, Ba'asara Mamarot Nivra Olam. That the world was created by speech. And it says, Umata Maloma Valoba Mamar Echad Yecholi Barot. He says, God could have created by one word. And one second, let's be honest. When it says in the Torah that God spoke, that's itself is an anthropomorphism. It's giving God human qualities. God also, it could have said that God created by snapping his fingers. Of course, you'll say to me, but God can't snap fingers because God doesn't have fingers. But God has a larynx, God has a voice, God has... I mean, the Rambam is very careful. The Rambam, when he's in the Guide for Perplexed, in the Maror Nevuchim, tells us that whenever it says in the Torah, and God spoke to Moshe saying, that's, by the way, that's missing in this week's parasha, that God spoke. Keep in mind, God's speech is missing over here. Why is it missing over here? Again, Rashi asked that question and took us in... Or excuse me, the Rashbam asked that question and took us in a different direction. But God's speech is missing over here. But the Rambam tells us whenever it says that God spoke, it should have said, and God caused sound to reverberate in Moshe's inner ear. But that's a little awkward. So instead of that, it uses Dibra Torah B'Lashon B'nei Adam, that God speaks in human terms, or, what's another way of saying it, it's an anthropomorphism. That God takes upon human qualities as that God spoke. God really doesn't speak as such. Which means... When you speak about leaving Egypt and God strikes the Egyptians with his mighty hand, that's an anthropomorphism, but also whenever it says that God speaks. So therefore, when we notice that God creates by virtue of speech, realize that God could have created by virtue of speech, God could have created by virtue of will. Right? God willed creation. Why do I need that God spoke and created? God could have snapped, God could have tap danced, God could have done anything, and creation would have been the result. So therefore it becomes quite interesting to us that it's specifically by virtue of speech whereby that God creates. And then, of course, there's a second part to this. And the second part to this, yeah? In terms of God's speech? Hold on, we'll see if I have a chance to get to it. The second part of this is of course... What makes us us? What makes humans humans? Or how are humans different from the other species? It really does seem to be the ability to speak. If you're looking like for one definitive thing which makes us different from the animal kingdom, again, you can say that animals make sounds and maybe even communicate, or maybe Dr. Doodle Little speaks or understands the animals. But nonetheless, the ability of man to speak would seem to be a specific manifestation of our Tzelem Elokim. And therefore, when it speaks of God, or speaking and creating, perhaps that's saying a lot more to us in terms of our creative abilities and in terms of our speech. Now, let's be careful, because when God speaks, things happen. When man speaks, we very often create lies, or disappointment, expectations, and all kinds of other, or damage, chaos or damage. Which means our speech, even though it is a godly tool, is ultimately very, very different. And again, if I think back about the sinat chinam somehow being connected to speech, I can then realize how I may be using something which is quite spiritual, because it's something which is godly, and misusing it is the corruption which causes ultimately the destruction.
Yeah. So we need to create. No, it's like, oh, it's quite
Right.
What's the difference in how we impact and react to
Correct. But it's different. Still different from God's creation. And you're absolutely correct that with a kind word, a person could create feelings of closeness, of friendship, of kinship, and can take a person off the ground and lift them up. So what we could do with speech is also something that we need to think about. But in order to focus us, look at source 13. Hatama Shlishi, so you missed the first two. This is a Sefer Toldot Yitzchak, written by, if I'm not mistaken, an uncle of Rav Yosef Karo, whose name was Yitzchak Karo. Source 13. Hatam HaShlishi Shekadosh Baruch Hu Ritza Sha'adam Shebishvilo Nivra Olam Yeh Sichli Kamalach. When God created us, He wanted our intellects to be spiritual. Again, just like I just now made an argument that man's ability to speak is what makes us spiritual, I also could have argued that man's intellect is what differs from the animal kingdom, and that is what makes us like the angels. Certainly not our eating habits. Right, okay, let's go where it's underlined two lines later. That man's work or impact or behavior connects to three things. What are these three things? Ma'aseh, dibor, machshava. That when we do things, we do things by one of those three, or two of those three, or all three of those three. Dibur, ma'aseh, machshava. You see, of course you realize that God could have created by machshava. God could have thought the world into creation. It could have said, and God thought, let there be light, and there was light. Because what difference does it make if God thought it or said it? Now, for us, in our world, how many thoughts have you had in your life that have not necessarily come to fruition? Today. Right? Meaning, we don't operate on a world of thought, even though thought is a very important aspect in terms of the larger picture. But you put it together, thought and action and speech, and you start to think, okay, we have these three things. He goes...
That's interesting that it's three words. It's ma'aseh, dibor, machshava. When we think it would be in the order that you put it in,
yeah,
which was thought, speech, and action.
Right. Which more likely is the way that it should be. And if you look at Kabbalistic writing, Zohar and onwards, where it talks about creation, that's the way that it talks about. It talks about the unfolding of the universe in terms of God's thought going down to speech and going down to action, even though by God there should not be any difference between them. It should be instantaneous. There should not be any... With us, there's a thought, and then it takes a while to articulate the thought. And even from the articulation, it takes time in terms of creating something. But part of what he's dealing with here is in Vayikra, the whole idea of the Korban. And what he's going to try to show is how the Korban tried to fix those three things, which I'm less interested, at least today, but that's the model that he's trying to get to. If you look for references to
the whole thing.
Right,
so
okay. Right, so if you look for references for speech and thought and action in rabbinic literature, I can assure you you'll find thousands of different choices. I pulled that one up because it was succinct. But we had many, many places we could have found that. See, it's also interesting in 14. This is the Shlach HaKadosh. The Shlach HaKadosh is Rav Yishai Horowitz. He was one of the people who took the Kabbalistic writings of the Arizal and caused them to eventually make it to Europe. If you know anybody who's a Horowitz, who's a Levi, then there's a good chance he's from that family. And there's a family custom, which they may or may not know of, and that is that they don't eat turkey. He wrote in his will that not to eat turkey. Didn't think it was kosher. I believe so. So, he quotes over here from a book called the Reishit Chachma, which is an older book, Kabbalistic and Musar ideas. Katav Reishit Chachma, Perikim Mishar Kedusha, Kedushat Shabbat, Hubimachshava B'dibur Maaseh. Shabbat has all three of these elements, which, by the way, makes a lot of sense because Shabbat commemorates creation. So Shabbat commemorating creation. Creation should have had within it also all three of the parts. Although it's interesting, what does creation actually have? It actually has speech. And speech is emphasized. And it's interesting that when we talk about what you can't do on Shabbat, the real problem has to do with what we call... What can't you do? Define what you can't do in work. You can't do on Shabbat what? Creative work. Good. And how do you say that in Hebrew? Melechet machshevet. So that means it's the combination of thought and action. That's what you can't do on Shabbat. Do you understand why I'm saying that?
They don't play Scrabble.
I don't know why they don't play Scrabble. They probably can't spell well. That's why I tell my wife I can't play Scrabble, because it's Shabbat, but I can't spell. No, this is a very important piece. On Shabbat, the type of work that we're prohibited from doing is called Melechet Machshevet. Creative work. What it means, it's a type of work which somehow combines machshava with action. So dibur is left out of that. Dibur is and I'm saying dibur is what it actually uses when it says that God creates, right? And God said with dibur God. So why is it left out? I can't question God, but it's interesting. The parallel where we learn the laws of Shabbat from. And I say the parallel, I mean, what I mean by the word parallel over here is, we don't directly learn Shabbat from creation, even though it's zech l'maseh bereshit, we learn the laws of Shabbat out from the building of the Mishkan. So any of the melechet machshevet, which is used to create the Mishkan, is what we can't use when we're in Shabbat. And dibur is not included in what you can't do by the Mishkan, or what they used by the Mishkan. Rather, it's what's called the melechet machshevet, creative work, and therefore dibur is left out. If you want to make a mental note of this, in source 10, Yeshayahu does say, "Im tashiv mi Shabbat raglecha asot chafatzecha b'yom kodshi v'karata l'Shabbat oneg l'kadosh Hashem mechubad v'chibadito me'asot rechecha mimtso cheftzecha v'daber davar." That the Navi does speak about being careful about speaking on Shabbat, but there the type of speech that he's referring to is a type of speech which is the mundane speech, and this is what I told you last week. This is Drabanan. It's not part of the Daraita, it's part of the Drabanan that one shouldn't speak on Shabbat the way that one speaks on other days, and there are all kinds of laws about that I'm not going to go into, because it will make your Shabbat more enjoyable. But there are definitely things that should not be, including business and how much did that cost, and all kinds of... Most of the talking in shul is not allowed. Well, just certainly the men's section. I don't know. So what he says, the Shlod then says, "Lo bati rakla," or in the bottom of 14, "Lo bati rakla orer al eiz devrim shelo dashu behem rabim." He said, he trampled upon. He goes, "I'm not coming to say things that people haven't said before me." Liot kimaskir ukimazhir, and to remind and to warn. Vine askir k'tushat dibur umachshava umaaser leinyan sur meira, that there are certain things in terms of the k'tusha of Shabbat, in terms of thought and action and speech, that one shouldn't do to stay away from doing bad. And there's lots of good things you can do with pure machshava, pure thought, pure deeds, pure speech. But by the way, let's just do a little bit of an exercise. Not all things in our lives combine all three of these things together. Right? Not even though we saw before, quoting that there are these three aspects, certain aspects you don't need all three. Here, for example, a korban, despite what I'm skipping before from the vidui, a regular korban needs two things. It needs ma'aseh and needs machshava. If a person, when they bring a korban, is thinking, "I'm going to eat this korban next week," that korban is pasul. The machshava destroys the korban. If you do it the wrong way, you shecht it the wrong way, it also destroys it. Which means the korban is a combination of ma'aseh and machshava. On the other hand, this may be of interest to you, that we have tefillah instead of the korban. By tefillah, it's not asiyah, it's dibur and machshava together. Which means you want the kavanah, you want the thought, together with the words to go together, but the ma'aseh isn't there. The dibur takes the place of the ma'aseh. Think about marriage for a second. Okay, don't think about it. No, think about marriage for a second. If a man were to approach a woman and to give her a ring and say, "Hareyat mukadeshet li b'tabat zuk kedat Moshe Yisrael," so then you have action, giving the ring, and you have speech. What about machshava? Do you need machshava? Exactly. No one would know. What if he comes afterwards and says, "I was kidding"? Right, 3 weeks later, you know what? I thought it was pretty funny, but I was kidding. Doesn't make a difference because the thought is not essential there. So what I just now showed you was three different cases, right? And if you think about it, you'll find a lot more. I showed you different cases. Some of them, all that you need is ma'aseh and dibur, right? Some of them you need machshava and dibur. And some of them you need ma'aseh and machshava. But, of course, if you're able to work all three of them together, then you'll be much better off. Yeah? Yeah?
The example that you just gave. here we
have communication without dibur.
Two witnesses present.
Yes.
Would they have all three elements?
No, because still the witnesses don't know what's in a person's heart. And certain things take place on a legal level where we can only judge what happened, which means over here, the dibur, the speech, and the action create the result, and even though I don't know what's going on in the world of machshava, the world of thought.
What does the pile?
Okay, so let's see if we get there. So let's pause a second, and I'm going to remind you of something which that we've looked at before, and maybe now we'll see where it fits in. Rabbeinu Bachai in Source 15 tells us, it's interesting, he goes to two different levels of how a neder works. And this is Rabbeinu Bachai locally in our parsha. He starts with Derech HaMidrash, and talks about the ability of making a neder, and we're going to skip that part and go to the next paragraph, which says Val Derech HaKabbalah, based upon Kabbalistic or traditional. Ish ki yador neder lahashem, neder milashon dira. But he says that what is a neder? The idea of a neder is a dira lahashem, an apartment for God. That's what a neder is. A dira is to make something, a place for God. Where's the first time that you find a neder in the Torah? The word neder used. So that goes in source number 16, Bereshit Kavchet, Vayidor Yaakov Neder. So remember, Yaakov took a nap. He sees this stairway to heaven, and then he gets up and he makes a vow, and he says, Vayidor Yaakov Neder. That Yaakov actually says two things in his vow. The first part of his vow is that he says that I will build a house for God. So therefore, the quintessential neder is to make a dira l'Hashem. The quintessential neder is to make a house for God, a Beit Elokim. That's what the neder is. So therefore, to say that a neder is dira l'Hashem would make a lot of sense in this first source. Although he actually says another thing as well. He says that whatever God gives me, I will give a tenth back to God. So there's a very fascinating Targum Yonatan. Source 17 is the pasuk that deals with Yaakov's wrestling match with this anonymous adversary. Vayivater Yaakov levado, vayavek ishimo adalot tashachar. Yaakov was all alone, and he wrestles with someone until the break of day. In Source 18, the Targum Yonatan on that verse, this is the Hebrew, the Keter Yonatan is a Hebrew translation of the Targum Yonatan. Vayishai Yaakov levado, me'ev lenar yubak, vayavek malach imo kidmut ish, vayomer halo amar, dila aser kol shulcha. Didn't you say you're going to give a tenth back to God? V'neyesh lecha treisar banim ubat achad. You have 12 sons and you have one daughter. V'lo ishartem. You didn't give ma'aser. You didn't give a tenth. What's going on over here? Miyad hifrish arba bichorim. He separated his four firstborn. Why? Because they were already considered holy. The firstborn at that point were considered holy, so he separates the first four. La'arba imahot. V'nisharu shmoneh. And he was left with eight. V'shana limnot mishimon. And then he starts to count from Shimon. So if you count from Shimon till 10, you'll get, Shimon's 1, you have 8, Shimon then will be 9, and number 10 will be Levi. Va'ala Levi b'ma'aser. And Levi became the 10th one, Levi becomes the ma'aser. Ana Michael v'yomar ribono sholam zehu chelkecha. This is for you. Now, it's very, very interesting, because if Levi becomes the 10th, by the way, this is the earliest reference, as far as I recall, of talking about Levi being special, and talking about, the Kohanim, when they come from Levi, because you would remember from the Chumash, by the Chet Egel, right? And then, Miva Hashem Elai, and all of Shevet Levi wake up. Over here, we have a source which is much earlier, but now if you think about the two parts of Yaakov's vow, what were they? One part was to build a house for God, which is a Beit HaMikdash or a Mishkan. And what's the second part? The second part is, I'm going to give you a tenth. But what does it mean I'll give you a tenth? I'll give you a tenth to work in that Beit HaMikdash, and that seems to be where Levi now will fit in. Now, this is the vow. What is the vow? Again, the vow is using words, and the words somehow create a reality or create an obligation. And the problem over here is making a vow and not necessarily keeping it. And by the way, if you were to go through rabbinic literature, you would find, best case scenario, a great deal of ambiguity towards vow making. It's not considered to be a great thing to make a vow. Matter of fact, let's look at source number 18 and a half, which means it's the one that comes after 18. And I'll explain to you why I looked in this source. Because it didn't make that much sense logically why I looked in this source. It's called the Yismach Moshe. And you have actually a whole bunch of quotes from him in this week's Parsha. As you see on the side, you know what? There's a mistake there. I pasted the wrong thing there. The Yismach Moshe is by somebody else. Yismach Moshe is by Rav Moshe Teitelbaum. If you look by source 26, there it gives you his information. 1759-1841. I'm supposed to speak on Shabbat, and every now and then I decide that I'll be lazy, and maybe I'll give the same talk more than once. So I'm supposed to speak by Shabbat by your Bar Mitzvah. And Bar Mitzvah is a son of a friend of mine. And even though I had a great thing to say by the Bar Mitzvah, then the father came over to me and said, listen, can I bring my son over? You'll give him the Torah to say? So I gave him over one. And then they asked me to speak twice. So I have two more things that I have to give, and I already gave him over one, so I had to come up with something else. But I decided, I knew the... Yeah, you should move. You have to start moving. I knew the grandfather. No, just there. Finish yourself. There, it's good. Okay. I knew the grandfather. The grandfather was a Hasidic Jew from Hungary, who was a Holocaust survivor, who was in camps and what? And the grandfather just died around 2 years ago. And I knew him well, and I decided that I was going to bring a Hasidic commentary from Hungary, because that would make the grandfather happy wherever he is. So I decided that's what I do. So I have to admit this, I did not off the top of my head know who was the first leading Hasidic person in Hungary. Who brought Hasidus to Hungary? So the answer is, this Rabbi Moshe Teitelbaum was the first one. He was a student of the Chozeh from Lublin. Lublin is not in Hungary. And he went and he took Hasidic Torah, and he brought it to Hungary. And he is the, I would assume, great-grandfather of the Satmar Rebbe, the same title-bound family. And there are a number of different Hasidic dynasties that came out off of this man, Rav Moshe Teitelbaum. So once I looked this up and I found it, and then I look for any more information I can find about him, and I see that he died July 17th, 1841. So, of course, I pull out my calendar and I start looking, and it turns out that July 17th, 1841 came out on this Shabbat, the day of the Bar Mitzvah that I'm speaking about. It's Shabbat, Parshat, Matot, Maaseh, the same exact day as his Yahrzeit. So I decided this was just something in Hashemayim, so obviously I had to go. Excuse me? We'll get to him. He was also a student of the Chosef from Lublin. He's a different source. It's the Igor de Kala, which we may get to. That's source 30. So he starts off as follows. Of Moshe Teitelbaum in the Yismach, Moshe writes, "Beposik v'deber Moshe el Roshe ha-matot l'vnei Yisrael, ish ki yador neder l'ashem, lo yachal diburo, kichol asher hotzei mipiv ya'aseh, v'yesh lo mebehekdem ha-gemara, Tov mizeu mizeh she'enu noder kol ikar. Better than making a vow and keeping it is somebody who doesn't make a vow at all. V'imkein lefizeh kol noder ra'a oseh. According to that, whoever makes a vow did something wrong. K'mo she'amru zal, as the rabbis have said, in darim kol noder, ki'ilu bana bama bishat isur habamot. Is as if he's created a bama. What's a bama? A bama is the opposite of the Beit HaMikdash. The bama is a... No. It's like a temporary mizbeach. By the way, it's very interesting. Yaakov makes a vow to build a Beit Elokim. Yaakov never did build a Beit Elokim. Yaakov builds a mizbeach. Or Yaakov builds a bama. Or Yaakov builds a... He builds other things, but he doesn't exactly make this Beit Elokim. And as we see, he has trouble for the vow that he made, and that's the first vow that we've seen. And over here it says, you know what, it's better off not to make a vow at all. Then he goes on and he says something which I thought is interesting and maybe is particularly good for a bar mitzvah. He writes in the next place where it's underlined, Uka Amram Ha'omer Ashkim Vashne Perigzeh Neder Gadol Nadar L'Elokei Yisrael V'chim B'chol Mitzvot. If a person makes a vow, I'm going to do a mitzvah, I'm going to do something positive, it's a good thing. V'hine Zev V'dai D'Kol Ish Choshev V'chol Yom Al Yom Machar, Shemin Az V'Halia Aser Ritzono Yitbarach. And he goes, that's what we do every day. Every day we say, you know what, tomorrow I'm going to do the will of God. Now why tomorrow? Eshkema. Tomorrow I'll do mitzvah. Why tomorrow? Ki Hayom Yitzro Tukfo. For today, your Yitzhahara gets the best of you. But what happens? Aval Ein Lo Hayom Yitzhahara Shel Machar. Today, you don't feel tomorrow's Yitzhahara. So you're able to say, right? This is how you can say, tomorrow I'm going to start a diet. How do you say tomorrow I'm going to start a diet? Because you don't smell tomorrow's food. You smell today's food. So looking and smelling and being in the room with today's food, your Yetzirah is there today, but you don't, so tomorrow I'll start the diet. He goes, therefore, for a person to say, tomorrow I am going to do this positive mitzvah, is a good type of a neder, because what you're doing is you're taking your positive machshava and you're connecting it with your dibur, and hopefully, yes for all three, and hopefully that will translate into the ma'aseh. And then all three come together. But the only way you can do this is if somehow you found this way of beating the Yetzirah. And that's what it says, V'hainu Amram, Yitzro shel Adam mitchadesh alav b'chol yom. Every day you get the new Yetzirah. V'chein b'chol yom shekarei kriyat Shema, shehumi deraita, harei mekabel avol malchut shemayim. And he says, therefore, every day when you say Shema, it's a positive thing, because then you hopefully are linking together the thought and the words and the action. And we'll skip the rest of this right now.
So you think today positively, but then you'll do tomorrow.
And hopefully the words, I will do that, creates for you the obligation that you'll be able to defeat the Yetzirah Tarah, because you made a vow. Once you made the vow, then don't do it. Then don't say it. But he's saying that's the way...
Tomorrow is really not an easy thing.
Excuse me?
Tomorrow is
starting a diet tomorrow is not always an easy thing.
Because it's always, because tomorrow, no. It's very easy. It's easy, but the problem is that tomorrow is always tomorrow. It never becomes today.
No.
It's always, it's always tomorrow. Tomorrow never becomes today. You're always going to start it tomorrow. Can somebody explain this?
Just one second.
The problem is you always have the attitude that tomorrow you'll start the diet. You never have the attitude, today I'm going to start the diet.
So then you're not breaking the neder? Is that what you're talking?
No, you're breaking the neder. It's bad. But right. But no, what he seems to be feeling is that once you make the neder, how can you make the neder? Because you don't feel the Yetzer Hara today. Mary, remember the story I told you about the Chafetz Chaim? Remember that? It wasn't so long ago. I think it was around a month ago I told you. One morning, the Chafetz Chaim wakes up. He's already 93, 94 years old. It's Poland in the middle of the winter. He's cold, he doesn't feel well, he has a cold, and he wakes up and he says, Yisroel Meir, you're an old man, you're weak, you're cold, you're tired. Go back to sleep and get a little more rest, and you can go to a later minyan. And he says he jumps out of bed and he goes to davening. And afterwards he tells the students what happened. And somebody says, listen, you know, without any disrespect, it's true. You are an old man and you are cold and you are tired. Why didn't you go back to sleep? So he says, because my Yetzer Hara is just as old as I am and he was already up and working. So the Chafetz Chaim is able to identify his Yetzer Hara, right? Right, he's able to identify. Right, I've seen the enemy. Right, he's able to identify the Yetzer Hara right now, right here. But what Yismach Moshe is telling us is very difficult when the Yetzer Hara is right there to defeat it. So therefore, he says, "No, use the dibur, use the vow to create the obligation, because the Yetzer Hara for tomorrow isn't here yet. So now you have this plan, this stealth. Right, you're going." Under the radar, and you're going to beat the Yetzer Hara, which isn't around yet, and that's how you're going to make the vow. But once it's a vow, then you have to keep it. Again, what happens if you don't keep it? That becomes something which is negative. But what he's saying over here is that the use of the vow is going to help create this unity between the machshava and the maaseh, and how you're going to create. Meaning, what's the problem? The problem is all of us have good thoughts, right? Here's the problem. I'm speaking for all of you now. We all have good thoughts. The problem is turning those good thoughts into reality. How do you make that link between the machshava and the ma'aseh? So what he's saying is by the dibur. But now there's a problem. That when the Yetzer Hara is right there, when that piece of chocolate cake is right there in front of you, you're not going to say, I'm starting my diet right now. Right? That's not going to happen. What you'll say is, I'm going to eat this. It's X amount of calories. I'll go on the treadmill for an extra this amount of minutes, and then I'll start my diet afterwards. That's what you end up saying, because it's right there. But you say, no. Use the dibur to link between the machshava and the ma'aseh, and then one will be successful. Because what he believes is that ultimately, Jews, and I don't mean right now to say only Jews, but we'll see this, maybe we'll see, that there's a sensitivity here, that Jews really do want to do the right thing, but sometimes you get a little stuck. Here's a great case that the Mishnah that the Gemara brings up. What if, God forbid, somebody is sick, and somebody then goes and says, "I'm going to give charity that my kid gets better." Right? Now, how many of us have ever done things like this? One would suspect most of this. Source 19, Gemara in Pesachim. If a person says, I am going to give this coin to charity so that my kid gets better, or that I should have a share in the world to come, it calls this person a tzaddik amor. Now, by the way, the Gemara itself is not sure why this person is a tzaddik amor. The Rishonim have a hard time with this. Rashi writes, Harei zeh tzaddik amor, source 20, b'davar zeh. So don't say he's doing it lo lishma. No, he really wants to give tzedakah. And he also wants to have the other advantage to it. We'll see. In source 21, Tosfot questions and says, but isn't this the case of don't be like the person who serves the master in order to get a reward? Right? That's in source 21. In source 22, we have the Gemara in Baba Batra quotes the same idea, but it adds one more thing. Go to the, where it's underlined, V'hatanya, ha'omer selezeh letztaka b'shvil she'echev b'ni, u'b'shvil she'eskalom abah ha'rezet tzadikim or, lo kasha. He says, no. Kan b'Yisrael kan v'oved kochavim. When a Jew says it, it's good. When an idolater says it, I want to be careful. An idolater says it, it's not good. It didn't say non-Jew. It says idolater. Actually, later on, if you want to look at source 25, he says it doesn't really mean non-Jew. It means, for example, a non-Jew. Look at Rashi in 23, and I'll slow down in a second. Harezet tzadik amor al davar ze umachshavazu. On the davar, because it's... What do you have over here, in this case? You have a link between giving the tzedakah, which is a ma'aseh, the machshava, and the dibur. And he says the person's a tzaddik. But you can all... What do you mean he's a tzaddik? What do you mean he's a tzaddik? He said, I'm giving tzedakah, my kid should get better. So, what Tosfot points out in source 24 is, what if, God forbid, the kid didn't get better? So he claims that the Jew will still say, I'm glad I gave the tzedakah. I did the right thing. While the idolater, again, I want to stress, and Ovid Kochavim will say, I can't believe this didn't work, I want my money back. Which means the attitude of an idolater is that there are all these forces on the planet, there is no one God, and by the way, work it through. If there is one God, that one God needs nothing from you. If there is one God, God created not out of need, but out of altruism. If there is one God who doesn't need anything, so then why would he do anything for God? You wouldn't. You would try to emulate God. So therefore, if God creates out of an act of chesed, and that's the dibur that God does, is chesed, what I want to do is to be like God, and I want to do chesed as well. The idolater, who's used to all kinds of different forces, is used to this relationship. Okay, what's the price I have to pay to this God that this God doesn't make my life into chaos? So, oh, this is the. I'll write the check and I'll give it to that particular God, and now we have things worked out. Which is the basic orientation between an idolater and somebody who believes in one God is going to be different, and therefore the Jew who does this, when they say, I'm going to give this charity and I want this kind of result, they don't reject what they've done, because what has happened now is their actions have somehow unified with this vow, with this neder. It somehow has unified with what's deep inside of them. And therefore the action brings out something which is positive. Let me show you another thought. Let's see. We'll skip a little bit. Source 27. Again, the Yismach Moshe. On this week's Parsha. Mamatzu avotechem bi'ol apia hayura dvash shapirish al amram bishar sha'am yisrael nasevin ishma. Then the angels come and say, you wanted Matan Torah, right? Na'aseh nishma migala raz ze libani, or libanai. Loshon shemalchei asheret mishtamshim bo. Kidata philosophim, the philosophers think, in order to get enlightenment, what do you need to do? Lahasig hasagot elokit v'devar nevuah, tzarich hachana behit chakmot, b'chakmot umuskolot hativit. That in order to get to enlightenment, you need to study science, study natural things, in order that one gets to the point of enlightenment and understanding God. Study the physical world till you get to understand the metaphysical. And so on. Umisham b'seichel elokit. Umekubalim chelku al zeh. They argued with this. V'amran, ki lo zeh mivi lidei ruach hakodesh v'nevuah, ki im ba'asot mitzvot u'ma'asim tovim b'shleimut u'v'chavana ritzuya. That what gets to enlightenment, that the na'aseh, and then the nishma, then you'll hear enlightenment. Which means, doing the will of God, na'aseh, doing it with proper kavana, that brings about the nishma. That brings about the enlightenment. Which means, ultimately, we will have problems in our lives when we have a disconnect between the machshava and the dibur and the ma'aseh. And what we want to try to do is to create as much unity between these things. And that's what a vow could be good for, because a vow can help us bring connection. I'm only going to bring one more source because we're getting late. And you all have to go, I know. Do whatever it is that you do when you're not here. You know what you do. And look at source number 30. This is from the Igra Dekala of Tzvi Elimelech. You never would have said Elimelech. But Tzvi Elimelech Shapiro. He is the author of the B'nai Yisachar, or as he would have pronounced, the B'nai Yisachar. No, see? It was a probe. Now we know why we taught this as well today. And he brings down a teaching from the Arizal, which now will take us to the second part of the parasha. First of all, he says, and by the way, this I'll admit as well, I knew all this before I read this inside. I was just looking for someone to say it. I knew that the whole parasha was linked by this concept of speech.
Parasha linked to both.
Going from the neder, going to the vow, going to the whole thing. And by the way, even in the middle, you have Melchemet Midian. What is it that Bilam did? He tried to use speech in order to curse the people. Which means that's there, and it was clear to me that there was this theme of speech, using or misusing speech, going all the way through the parasha. So he actually points it out, but then he points out one more thing, which I also knew, and I was looking for someone to say, and he said it, so that's why he made it here. He quotes the Arizal, he quotes the Sefer Likutim, and look toward, and the first part he says there's a link in the whole parasha. That's what he says in the beginning. Umik narav smichut sipur maaseh lakan ulakesher kol haparasha beseder. And he starts to talk about nidarim and the connection between the thought and the speech and the action, all that is here. And then at the end he points out, Ayin belikutei Torah v'ayin ba'asarat memorot liyot shehaya behem kam b'machshava b'reshit havayatam. He's answering a question. Why is it, and I don't want you to go crazy on me on this, I'm not going to talk about this, I'm just going to tell you what it says, and then you move on with your lives. Let me tell you what it says first. He says, what's the reason that Shevet, Reuven, and God, and half of Menashe, can't go into Israel? Why is it that they have to stay outside? He said there's something lacking when they were created. He says, there was a disconnect between the machshava and the ma'aseh. When Yaakov sleeps with Leah and impregnates her with Reuven, who did he think that he was with? He thought he was with Rachel. So therefore, there was a problem with the machshava in terms of the creation of Reuven. Reuven has internally this disconnect between ma'aseh and machshava, and therefore there's a lack of kedusha. He can't go into Israel. He then says, "What about by God? God," and he brings the verses to back himself up. Again, all this comes from the Arizal. By God, that's when Rachel gave Yaakov, said, "Listen, it's not fair, take Bilha," and then Yaakov agrees. By Zilpa, it never says that she talks to him. Leah says, well, if you can take Bilha, then I'm going to give him Zilpa, and he gives him Zilpa. But it never says that Yaakov responds or Yaakov even knows about it. Over here he says, obviously Yaakov didn't know about it, and therefore the creation of God, that he thought he was with Leah. It was Leah's turn, quote unquote, she brings Zilpah there in her place. Yaakov sleeps with Zilpah, gets her pregnant, and therefore again he says that there's a problem in terms of the connection between the Machshava and the Maaseh. And then he goes, well, what about half of Menashe? So that brings us to what we learned last week. Who was Yosef married to? Asnat. Who's Asnat's mother? Dina. So therefore, you're going to have, how many children does Yosef and Asnat have? Two. So, Yosef and Asnat, that's all fine. Yosef, in terms of Yaakov and Rachel, that's fine. But Asnat comes from Shem and Dina, so therefore you have one quarter, which isn't good, so therefore half of Menasheh can't go in because of the missing connection between Maaseh, and that's what the Arizal explains, that ultimately these tribes that can't go in is because of this disconnect between... I'll read the words inside now. Ayin bilikute terav, ayin basar mam, wrote, liyot shem behem pgam b'machshava b'reshit havayatam, dineber uvein choshav Yaakov shehi Rachel, v'ital Leah kinoda. Right? He thought it was Rachel, it was really Leah. V'gam b'leidat gad, lo nitya atzal Leah im Yaakov, kamoshe nitya atzal Rachel, and he says, look at the verses up, v'natad lo et zilpah b'lo hoda, without discussing it. V'yagam kein chasaron b'machshava, uv'chatsi shevet menasheh, liyot she lakach et osnat, shaita batina mishchem, v'nei shchem machshavato liznut, v'dina haita tzadikat. Nitpagma osnat b'miktzat, v'lecha Yosef shehi kulo tamim, nishar hapgam b'revia, one quarter is off, so one quarter from the two children comes out to half of Menasheh, u'shnei shvatim hayu liyosef, v'chatsi shevet, hu revi'i, alken chatsi shevet Menasheh, l'kach nachlato michutz la'aretz hakdusha. M'meile kol ha'parsha mizaheret la'adam, eich yishmor machshavato, sh'tiyeh b'tahara v'haven. Therefore, this whole parsha is about, and I'll add a little bit to this, linking together the three, the thought and the speech and the action in order to create Kedusha. Shabbat Shalom.